From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Minnesota, 2003. Researchers at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis released a new study that showed something significant about early education. If it's high quality, then the benefits extend beyond the kids who receive that early education. Crime rates could go down. Social service expenses would go down. And the biggest returns come when high-quality early education is offered to kids at risk or in poverty. And if this seems strictly like a government funding issue, in other words, government can increase or decrease the funding, it's not exclusively in this case. In Minnesota, a group of business leaders decided to use this evidence to build a strategy for providing even more early childhood education and better. And that group is now called Minnesota Business for Early Learning. It includes CEOs and senior executives. But again, that was back in 2003 and 2004. And we're kind of curious, have their efforts worked? What does the evidence say? Beyond that one issue, what about broadly speaking when it comes to funding childcare and subsidies, help for parents, help for kids? Well, today, one of the researchers behind that initial study is in Rochester presenting on this issue. And there are advocates for early childhood education wondering, what would happen if Rochester had that same kind of investment from the Western New York business community? This hour, a conversation about the evidence behind early intervention, behind child care funding, and high-quality early education. Let me welcome my guests, and they include Rob Grunewald, economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Nice to have you in Rochester, Rob. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Larry Marks is here, executive director of the Children's Agenda. Larry, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan.
And Jen O'Connor's here, New York State Director of Council for a Strong America. Jen, welcome, and tell our audience, if they don't know what Council for a Strong America is, what is it?
Thanks, Evan. Council for a Strong America is a national nonprofit. There is a New York State office based in Albany. And what we do is we leverage the voices of unique messengers. So law enforcement, business, and retired military in support of proven investments in children and families. And today we're talking about the economic return on investment of early learning.
And before the hour even began, you said to me, there's a crisis in the state, yes?
There is a huge crisis, particularly in the earliest years, 0 to 3, 0 to 8. We are putting money into certain discrete programs, such as pre-K, but we're still not serving all children. And we're not putting nearly enough funding into programs like home visitation and childcare.
And Jen, from your lens, is that mostly a government funding issue? Does the business community have a role here? How do you view that?
I think the business community could certainly match certain government funds, but I do think it's a primarily a federal and state funding issue. And looking at it as less of a human services issue and more of a workforce development, economic development issue, there should be more funding put behind it.
All right, let me turn to Larry Marks before we kind of have Rob dig into some of the research. Larry, we got to at least establish a problem. Jen is talking about a crisis, especially 0 to 3. In your eyes here, you know, you look at what's happened in Monroe County alone. And our listeners go well beyond Monroe County, but let me just take Monroe County as an example. You know, you sent some data over from, I think, 2001 to 2015. We've seen a large drop in the number of kids who are benefiting from child care subsidies, first of all, right?
Yeah, there's a huge unmet need. 8,300 kids who would be eligible, whose parents are in the workplace but in poverty, would take advantage of the child care subsidy program if they could. Instead, they have to choose between what's best for their job or what's best for their kids. And that's a sacrifice no public policy should ever ask us to make.
Okay. When it comes to why we've seen this 15-year decline, is it at the county level? Is it at the state level? I mean, certainly Larry's job is you work with a lot of people. I know you have a lot of respect for lawmakers of all backgrounds here, but you know, people all are looking for a reason,
right,
not to play a blame game, but what's happening?
Well, and we're an equal opportunity advocate, so
sure,
it comes down to all levels of government, and not just government. The private sector have to step up. It's an all-hands-on-deck situation, and there is as Jen said, a crisis when it comes to child care and early childhood systems generally. And the county needs to put more funding in. Certainly the federal government needs to put more funding in, and certainly the state. On our front page of our website today, we have letters that we're coordinating statewide to urge the New York delegation to put more funding behind the community or the child care block grant, which is the primary source of funding for all these slots. And the state then has to match a lot of that funding, and the state needs to put in more money as well. So there are two letters on our website at www.thechildrensagenda.org.
When County Executive Maggie Brooks was in her final year of office last year, she, this program, said that a lot of this comes down to state decisions, and that the county is strapped in its own way, and that the state is really to blame for that. Is that fair?
It's true, but it's not enough. The point is that all government officials point at every other level of government as saying it's their responsibility. They're the ones who own this problem. And then there's this little circular firing squad where nothing gets done, nothing moves, and nobody takes responsibility for their own decision making. And we have reason to believe this county administration might start to make a difference on this issue. We're cautiously optimistic, but we don't want to rest on any level of government. It's really an all-hands-on-deck situation.
And what do state leaders say when you call on our state delegation to respond in this way?
They point to the federal government, of course. And again, they're right, but that's not enough. The state has to put in more money as Rob will explain, for the next generation of customers, employees, employers, and also to help with the current workforce that's struggling between absenteeism and productivity losses and doing what's right for their kids.
Okay. And what happened this morning? Why did you bring Rob in? I asked because, as I understand it, Rob's job is not to be an advocate. His job is, as an economist, is to help present the data and then allow the community to do with it what they think is best here. We always say on this program, we're evidence-based people. I think we have an evidence-based listening audience here. You wanted to bring in Rob for whom today, Larry?
Well, in credit where credit's due, it's Jen O'Connor and the Council for Strong America that has pulled Rob in and has this connection. But as a Federal Reserve economist and with the full weight and credit of the Federal Reserve Bank system, that is a different message. As he said so eloquently today, you know, I love kids, but he said, look, you don't even have to like kids to understand that this is an important issue because our entire economy rests on making a difference for the current and future workforce by these investments in early childhood. So that the message was to the business community. We want to see more business leaders like Sandy Parker. Bob Duffy has already done this, really step up to the plate and understand that we have to be talking with one voice to government about the wise, evidence-based investments in early childhood.
Okay. Well, Rob, was that fair to characterize your work as not an advocacy, but just sort of more of an evidence-based set of work?
That's correct. As a Federal Reserve economist, I'm an economist at one of the 12 banks around the country, and we're interested in understanding how economies grow, what are those core ingredients of economic growth, and we find that investments in early childhood are one of those ways to help improve the long-term productivity of the workforce. So as an economist, I'm taking this from a research angle, and as communities and states learn about the research, that they can use it for helping their policy decisions.
All right, listeners, if you want to weigh in on this with any questions or comments as we talk about the impact of child care subsidies, funding, high-quality early education, your thoughts on that, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And before we kind of go back to that 2003, 2004 and kind of work forward, because I think that's an interesting place to start, I also want to ask, Rob, after all we've heard in the last 10 minutes or so about the benefits of increasing funding, of restoring some funding cuts, of seeing the ROI, there has to be some point where there's a diminishing of returns, right? I mean, you can't spend in perpetuity, but in general, does the evidence say that we're so far short of that we don't have to worry about that? I know we've got conservative listeners who will say, this sounds like spend, spend, spend. What can we at least reasonably sort out when it comes to, you know, how much you can spend before there's less of a return?
When we look at the research, those investments that target children who are most at risk, and here we're referring to children who are growing up in low-income families or in poverty, or those that are subject to adversity early on, let's say exposure to violence or abuse or neglect in their homes or their communities or other issues with the household that put them at risk. Reaching these children is where you find the strongest benefit. And that the continuum of investments start as early as prenatal counseling to at-risk expectant mothers through quality childcare, access to quality healthcare, and preschool. And certainly as we look at the population of children who come from these more disadvantaged situations, is that we see that there is a large number that aren't able to access the benefits of these programs. So we still have what you might call a low-hanging fruit out there to take advantage of.
Yeah, in other words, Larry Marks might say, this should be easy.
Right? Yeah, it really should be.
Yeah, and Jen, to Jen's point, Rob just mentioned prenatal care. And that goes to your point, Jen, because a lot in the last couple of years, the focus has been on pre-K, which I think a lot of people in your line of work and Larry's line of work is excited about that. But to some degree, there's a peril to saying, well, at least we got pre-K done and that's kind of enough.
Well, I think there's a peril to saying that we got pre-K done.
Because, at all, right?
Yeah,
right.
We're still looking at less than 50% of four-year-olds across the state having access to high-quality pre-K. And we are then neglecting the 0-3 population, in essence. So we really need to invest in prenatal, maternal, infant, and early childhood home visiting and high-quality childcare, and really close that gap. We can close the gap, I think, between the new paid family leave program and the governor's pre-K program. There's a real childcare chasm there that we could be focusing on.
And so let me then ask Rob that question, because we just heard Jen mention the term high quality. In early education, what does high quality mean? And going back to your work in 2003, can you tell me about that work that was released then and how you sort of defined high quality?
Sure. So in 2003, when Art Rolnick, he's our former director of research at the Minneapolis Fed, we looked at really two bodies of research. The first is neuroscience and developmental psychology that just points to the importance of the early years for brain development and child development. And for example, by the age of 3 or 4, about 85% to 90% of all of the connections that are formed in the brain are, you know, essentially formed by that time. And so the early years are a sensitive period for development that have lifelong implications. So we want to be sure that we're helping kids and getting it right early instead of waiting later. The second piece is evidence that looked at the impact of providing high-quality childcare or home visiting or preschool to that more disadvantaged population. And because those studies were able to show long-term results years later with highly controlled studies, we can be confident in the type of returns over there. So if we look at the quality of those programs, they had well-trained teachers that were really effective with engaging children in their natural state of play to allow that to conduce effective brain development and child development. Relatively low ratios of children to those teachers, using research-backed methods in their working with kids, and for home visitors also using, you know, having well-trained professionals and using research-backed methods.
And so you have this research in your hand back in 2003, 2004, and I opened the program telling some of the story, but why don't you tell us what the Minnesota business community, how they responded to that and what they wanted to do with it?
So in Minnesota, back in 2004, Minneapolis Fed, we released our paper showing that these investments have a high rate of return. It's largely a public return. That is, most of the benefit is accruing to the taxpayers, to the non-participants of the programs, because you're reducing costs in remedial education, reducing costs in the long run to crime, and other social costs. And so you can reduce those and you get this high public benefit. Our business leaders were interested in that study, but also a second study that looked at kindergarten readiness. And in Minnesota, only about half the children were fully prepared to succeed in school. And as you might note in Minnesota, as Garrison Keillor would note, all the children in Minnesota are supposed to be above average, to quote another public radio star.
Yeah, that we have a receptive audience for that line.
And so business leaders were concerned. They came together. They educated themselves about early childhood development, the type of investments they can make, and decided to invest some of their own money into some research projects to help our state move forward in this area. And they invested in a quality rating system, which is similar to the Quality Stars New York pilot that's underway here in terms of a pathway to help programs improve quality and provide information to parents about how to shop for high-quality childcare. And the business leaders also invested in an early learning scholarship program for low-income children so that parents could choose a high-quality program of their choice for 2 years before they go to kindergarten. And they wanted to do some research on that, come to the legislature, to the governor, provide some recommendations. And that's been helpful in our state of moving those investments forward with the business leaders as essentially a third party trusted partner at the table. And they did raise a fair amount of money. It took $20 million to fund the projects and the research.
Now in 2016, how are Minnesota children doing when it comes to school readiness?
So the bar has been moving in a positive direction, but there's still a ways to go. The quality rating system has certainly helped programs improve their quality in terms of increasing their ratings and teacher qualifications and using research-backed methods. And there's more children in our state who are accessing high-quality experiences. But even in Minnesota, we're still just reaching a fraction of those kids. We have a bit further to go to reach all, let's say, 3- and 4-year-olds, as this particular focus of this program is.
Jen O'Connor, when it comes to our own state and the question of quality rating systems for childcare, certainly on the surface, it's an easy to understand idea, but I wonder if there is any pushback from anybody in our community, whether it's parents, whether it's childcare providers, who might say it's too subjective, it's unfair. You know, do you think this can be effective for parents?
I do, and I think because Quality Stars New York is a quality rating and improvement system, it's rating programs as you would a hotel or a movie, but at the same time, it's offering professional development opportunities and technical assistance to teachers in childcare settings and also in pre-K settings. Unfortunately, the funding isn't there yet to have it operate as much more than a pilot program, and so it is statewide, but serving just a handful of kids. And I think the evidence shows that, you know, we're one of just a handful of states that doesn't have a quality rating system in place. And other states have shown very good outcomes with coupling that. So we haven't seen any pushback on it. I think there is still skepticism about the need for access to high quality as opposed to just access to programs. And I think everyone around the table would agree that access to a lousy program is money that's just being kind of flushed away. And so we really need to invest in high quality.
Larry, you nodded immediately. You want to add to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, we need to incentivize a race to the top for increased quality. It does no child and no family any good to sit a kid in front of a television with a Kool-Aid box. That's babysitting. That's not high quality early child care. And when you are as fascinated as we become with early brain growth and development, you have to appreciate this is an amazingly complex and beautiful work of art that's developing that has to be nurtured and cared for with loving, attentive adults.
Yeah, I will not name a name in this case because this is only hearsay, but I can tell you that a friend recently told me a story about dropping her toddler off at a program that I think a lot of people would assume is in the high quality range. And after several visits of finding out, it was largely just sitting down with other kids in front of a television screen and being given, you know, snacks with no physical play, even though there was a lot of physical space. She pulled them out. And again, since it's just hearsay, I'm not going to mention the name. But my concern in hearing that was, this place, that's happening? How common is that? My concern is, if the reputation of this place is so good and that's happening there, how many more places is this happening? And I don't know if anybody has an easy answer, Larry, but my concern is that probably happening more often than we think.
Well, and I think what a quality rating and improvement system allows parents to do is make informed decisions so they know what to look for. So they may walk into a bright, beautiful center with some loving adults who don't know how to teach young children. And so I think that that's a positive for Quality Stars New York, that it allows parents to make an informed, educated choice.
Yeah, I think it's one thing for people who are not really trained on working with kids. Mm-hmm. It's another where, you know, in this case, it just sounded lazy to me. You know, that's not at all what I would expect. And then I think about parents living in poverty who maybe don't have a lot of options, and to the point that Jen and Larry are making is, you know, if you feel like, well, at least we got a child into a program, you may assume the outcomes are going to be better, but...
Yeah, and there's safety. That's always an important factor, and so not to be overlooked. But I think the important point here from our point of view, and certainly I know a business point of view, is let's not waste resources, precious, scarce resources, have to go to what works, not what doesn't. And particularly in the child care subsidy program, luckily, in the Rochester area, the greater Monroe County area, we do have a rich array of early high-quality child care programs. It's some of the best measured and evaluated anywhere in the country. The problem is, again, that it's not at scale. 8,300 kids who would gleefully, their parents would enroll them in these programs, can't get access to it. And then there's no integration and connections between home visitation and the school systems and the healthcare systems. A lot of that has to be better handoffs.
All right. So let me turn back to Rob Grunewald, who is here from Minnesota. He is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. When you are trying to study the long-term outcomes for kids who benefited from high-quality early intervention, high-quality early education, high-quality programs, versus kids that either, you know, might have been in programs that we would deem not as high-quality or no programs at all, I would think there's so many variables that would make it difficult to land it. Because you mentioned lower crime down the line, lower need for social services, benefits for taxpayers because we're not picking up the bills when people are either incarcerated or struggling and all these things. But you would think there's a lot of variables that would make it hard to really zero in on it. Unless it's really strong, unless it's so clear when you look at these different cohorts. Can you talk to me about how you would sort out the kind of variables to make it so that you can comfortably conclude this works when it's done well?
A lot of this has to do with how a study is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? What happens before the study begins? When you can do what's called a randomized control trial, and this is where you have a population who is willing to be part of the study. They understand that a coin is going to be flipped and that they're going to be in the treatment group, they're going to get the intervention, or they might be in this control group, this comparison group. That act of randomizing your study is able to give you the confidence that the children who received the preschool program or the high-quality child care program or home visiting program, that the differences you see with those children relative to the control group are because of the program itself. That is how you're able to sort it out through a randomized controlled trial. So, for example, one of the widely studied examples of this is the Perry Preschool Program, which back in the 1960s were able to randomize a group of low-income children either to receive a high-quality preschool program for 2 years or to be in the control group, and then able to follow them up until the age of 40 and then look at all of those differences. So even though you're at the age of 40, because way back when you did the randomization properly, you can attribute differences between those two groups, let's say in home ownership rates, in earnings, in crime rates, to the preschool program itself.
All right, and so we're now entering a time where we're going to see a lot more of these long-term studies, or at least we're probably seeing more, groups of kids. I would assume there's a lot of studies happening in a lot of different places where we're seeing more measurement over time. Is that right?
What's happening is that trying to understand how to sort out short-term measures and what they indicate so that we can learn more quickly about how programs are developing. We have the benefit not only of the Perry Preschool Program, but three other long-term studies that show these long-term benefits. In contemporary day, we want to be able to understand, well, if we have children in a program for a year or two or three, that we can look at some measures and understand how that program is doing. And actually, the science of that is still being worked out. In some programs, we might see that these early scores may have declined, but if we continue the follow-up or look at other data sets, we still see the kids doing well in middle school and high school and having some stronger adult outcomes. So the professionals in this area are certainly, tweaking how to understand these early gains, but a lot of it comes back to how the field is understanding what makes up quality. And that's still being sorted out, but we have some understanding of what type of ingredients we want in those programs to achieve positive outcomes for kids.
All right, listeners, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, I've got some emails from you, one from a skeptic, but others from parents who are sharing their experience. And parents, if you want to do that, that's great, too. I mean, I certainly would love to hear from parents about the struggles, the challenges of finding quality child care, affordable childcare. And affordable means different things for different people. And so much of what we've talked about is helping families, especially struggling families, families in poverty. But if you want to share your experiences on finding high quality daycare, childcare, et cetera, I'll read some of your emails that have come in already. And then we'll also get to some of your phone calls. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You just heard from Rob Grunewald, economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Jen O'Connor is here, the New York State Director of Council for a Strong America. And Larry Marks, Executive Director of the Children's Agenda. We're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Unshackle Upstate is a pro-business group, and they're just out with their 2015-2016 legislative scorecards. They want voters to have this information before going to the polls. We'll find out what the pro-business group thinks about how our lawmakers are doing. Then second hour, the chief of cardiology goes vegan and loses 57 pounds. His personal story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson and Larry Marks from the Children's Agenda. What's the short answer for if Rob's visit today here in Rochester, if Jen's work, if this is successful, the business leaders that you know, you mentioned Sandy Parker, Bob Duffy now, of course, and the business leaders who have been hearing from them today, if it works, what's going to happen in our community?
I think our government leaders will be hearing a lot more from business leaders about this is actually the economic interest of our companies, that we see more childcare in our communities of high quality. We've certainly seen exemplary companies like Xerox put their political capital on the line to make efforts to convince elected officials at the state level to invest more in childcare. There are a number of others at the local and federal level that do the same. So that's what it'll look like.
It's not an either-or proposition, in other words. Spend more money on funding these kind of programs, or don't spend the money, but, have a stronger, vibrant economy. It's not either or. In fact, they're intertwined, you said.
Well, and we have to understand the enormous cost of our present system of inadequate early childhood systems. I mean, we spend so much money on everything from treating substance abuse to the lost income from people who never graduate high school, never go to college, all the health problems that people have. One of the amazing things to me still is that if you just have 2 years of high quality early child care as a 2 or 3 year old, when you're 40 or 50, you have less heart disease and the kind of impact that that has. It's stunning. And we are so misspending our money on the back end as opposed to the front end.
All right, let me start with a phone call in Naples. Go down to Naples, and this is Brian. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if you've heard of Drew Academy Charter School in Atlanta, Georgia. They take children as young as 2 weeks old, go right through 12th grade, and they have a 98% proficiency rate in a neighborhood that started out as one of the most crime-ridden, poorest in the city. But the neighborhood's, of course, changing. But it shows what you can do if you get the kids early.
Yeah, Brian, stay there for a second. Have you guys heard of this? I'm not offhand. So we have not, but what do you make of the point he's making there, Larry?
Well, the point is, again, the earlier the better, yeah. And that home visitation programs work with parents and with families in the home and works with pregnant moms. So the nurse family partnership, 1,400 families served so far to date, that has probably meant, according to all the best evidence, fewer early childhood deaths, over hundreds of fewer cases of child abuse and neglect in our community. And yet, 400 families, 400 to 450 families served a year locally. We estimate the need is about 1,100 families in the Monroe County area who need the program can't get it because of inadequate investments.
Okay. Jen, what do you think?
I think the earlier the better, and I think also the continuum is important. You can't, I would hate to see us start to focus exclusively on 0 to 3 and neglect the elementary years. So I think that we have to do both, and we will see those huge savings. And we'll also see a connection to parents. High quality programs like voluntary home visiting, like childcare, like pre-K, like after school, have a parent engagement component. So you are strengthening the families. And I think that's incredibly important.
All right. Let me try to summarize a rather lengthy email from a listener named Phil. And Phil, since it's such a long email, I'm going to try to summarize. Call the program if I got any of this wrong. And again, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Phil's point is that he thinks government is inefficient to begin with, and that when we talk about more government funding on any level, local, state, federal, that it is going to lead to more poor outcomes, and that one of the conversations he's hearing in this hour is, even for some of the programs, not all, that currently exist, some of them are not really adequate to begin with, some of them are inefficient, and he's saying this is not a spend more tax dollar situation, this is a strengthen family situation, don't expect to spend more money and get better results. Phil, I think I am explaining that as best I can there. I'm going to go around the table. Jen O'Connor, what do you think?
I think part of it for me would be spend more, but spend better. We are investing in programs that we know don't work. And so we really need to.
I know every listener is going, name one. What are they?
Well, no, I don't want to get into that, but I think we need to focus more on research-based programs,
sure.
Promising practices. And I think in terms of strengthening families, absolutely. And I think any high-quality program will help to strengthen a family as well.
Okay, but you disagree with this premise that increasing funding is going to lead to simply more inefficiency and not improve outcomes?
No, I mean, I think that there's a difference between government funding and government takeover. We're not talking about government programs per se. We're talking about government putting in more money so that, in part, community-based organizations can have a place at the table to help with these outcomes.
Okay, Larry Marks?
Well, I just want to rise to the challenge and say that the DARE program, for instance, that has been proven not to be effective in reducing alcohol or drug abuse in teens, and we spend money on the DARE program that's wasted money and should be spent. At least it doesn't do any harm. The Scared Straight program does harm. In randomized controlled trials, it's been proven time and again. The evidence shows that program to scare the heck out of kids who are suddenly meeting prisoners behind bars to prevent them from doing any criminal behavior, that actually has a negative consequence. And it actually—
Is that right?
Yeah. It actually is more likely that the kids in that program will be committing offenses than not. So those are two examples. There are many more examples of how we inefficiently spend money. So I do agree with the point that government has to be smart, not just generous. Government has to focus, and our tax dollars, which are such precious resources, have to go to what works. And part of that can be by stopping spending on what doesn't.
Listen to the evidence. Listen to the work of people like Rob. You know, and you can easily pick out other government programs that we still throw money at. The 10 highest states of unwanted teen pregnancy are all in states generally contiguous in the South that fund abstinence-only education programs. Yeah, that doesn't work, but they still fund it. So the bottom line is that, Larry, you're accepting Phil's premise that government can be inefficient, but the government has to not take over, as Jen says, listen to the evidence, fund the programs that are working.
Right.
Which can be done. What you're saying, those programs do exist here, and we can expand them. We can do more with it.
Yeah.
Okay, Rob?
So for childcare and preschool, this is really a market. I mean, this is a rich market of programs that some of them do come from the public sector, but there's a lot of nonprofits and for-profits that are providing these services. And two-thirds of the dollars, and you know, more than two-thirds in most areas in the country, come from parents, you know, paying money, paying tuition for their kids to go to childcare and to preschool. So the when government is spending money in this, it's providing incentives so that families can access that market and also to provide incentives to improve the quality of that market. So it's still very much family driven. Parents are choosing programs. We want to be able to provide them with resources and also with high quality choices.
Okay, let me back to your phone calls in Rochester. This is John. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I agree. We've got to get more child care, but I think to put that burden on the taxpayer and businesses, I think it's the wrong strategy. I think we have contributed enough. I think now we have to look at the public unions. One of your last callers mentioned the charter schools. We are being overwhelmed, especially in New York State, with public unions. And what we need is a voucher system, a right to work legislation throughout the United States. Because whether the government's involved with child care or not, or some of these programs, the burden of government takes away from child care programs. So I think you guys should start focusing on, with the business leaders, focusing on the public unions, right-to-work legislation, and a voucher system to get this monkey off everybody's back and give more direct money to the people that need it.
Thank you for the phone call, John. Let me go around the table. Larry, Rob, go ahead, Rob.
You know, just to note that the way the child care subsidy system works is essentially a parent choice voucher system. They're provided resources for them to choose among programs. So there are elements of that parent choice, market-driven, you know, approach. And that the players at the table, we just always want to make sure are focusing on quality. And to the extent that there is provision in public schools, that unions are also supporting education and professional development for their teachers is important. That's part of what unions do too.
Rob, can I also just ask you to weigh in on the question of whether this is all, for lack of a better term, and I think maybe to borrow some of what you told RBJ, downstream. In other words, if we increase funding for child care subsidies, programs that we think are evidence-based, if that happens at whatever level, state, local, county, if there's more federal funding, the idea that we're hearing is it has all these long-term benefits to the child, to the family, to our community in many different ways. Are there shorter-term benefits?
There are. They're shorter-term. For example, reductions in the need for special education is a benefit that comes relatively early on, and also reductions in grade retention. Just making kids ready for school makes those classrooms more productive. But even earlier, some of the investments in home visiting help home environments become safer, so you have less visits to the emergency room. Also, stronger birth outcomes. So if you have children that are being born at full term, at, you know, with full gestation, that these kids are more likely to be healthy. They're less likely to be drawing down on some expensive medical care costs coming down the road.
All right, so before I read Alyssa's email, I just want to ask Jen O'Connor and Larry Marks then, if this evidence is piling up from Rob and colleagues around the country, why are we seeing government funding go down? I mean, as much as people may have a cynical view of government, I do think most elected leaders want to make smart choices, want to make choices that help kids. I mean, Jen, why have we seen this happen?
I think there are competing priorities. And so I think that we need to start looking at early learning as an economic development strategy. I think that we haven't probably done enough work to convince policymakers that it is, and that it's also a workforce retention strategy for the existing workforce. And I think that that's part of the intent of today's business leader breakfast, was to get those unique voices of business leaders out there talking about how important this is to building their communities. And once we make that argument, in addition to the vocabulary argument, the brain architecture argument, then I think we will begin to convince some other people.
Okay. Larry Marks.
Well, I think elected officials function in 2 or 4 year time horizons, which doesn't always match up to the time horizon of a child and a child's growth. And there's also a sense where we expect kids to develop self-regulatory behaviors and delay gratification, but we don't model that really well in our public systems by the way in which we spend money. It's a lot more gratifying to have a payoff of a new building or roads or a bridge if you're functioning in 2 and 4 year time horizons than it is to think about another 40 high school graduates 16 years later, or less 40-year-old adults in the hospital system with heart disease because of 2 years of high quality early care and education. So the problem is there's this mismatch, a temporal mismatch between the way priorities are set and what our children expect from us and need.
Well, and I think that some listeners will find it almost horrifying that strategically we've got to convince the business community to get on board the ROI train with this. treating children as sort of ROI machines, as opposed to saying whether this was good ROI or not, morally we should do this. But I think that's probably just pragmatism. You know, I mean, I'm not at all denigrating the strategy.
Yeah. Well, you know, faith leaders often say all roads lead to God. So, I mean, there are a number of messengers that will make the moral argument. We work with an interfaith collaborative that is righteously focused on the moral imperative of making change for our kids. Business has a role to play about making the hard-nosed economic arguments and having the political clout, frankly, to shift public policy in a rational, economic-based direction. Higher education has a role to play, and healthcare professionals and institutions have a role to play in this, too.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Maggie in Scottsville, next up. Go ahead, Maggie.
Hi. I was a child care administrator in the 70s and 80s. I was the assistant director in an inner city center here in Rochester, and then I was the director at a suburban, more prosperous center. I'm disappointed that we're still having the same conversations about funding that we did back in the day. I remember going and demonstrating at the county legislature, and the men in suits were saying things like, you're just warehousing our children. What I'd like to know, to bring it back to a less emotional level, is have you looked at successful models in other countries, say maybe France or Denmark? How do they support providing top quality child care to their population?
Maggie, thanks for the phone call and the perspective. And it's an interesting question. Rob Grunewald is someone who studies what others have been studying. Have we looked outside our own country?
Well, in terms of referring to what's happening, you know, around the globe, Europe does have a lot more supports for families that have young children in terms of paid leave, access to child care, and preschool, certainly. But we recognize that our country is set up more as a market-based economy. So we have differences in how we approach providing those services. So I wouldn't say that we would look like France or Germany, where you do have a universal 3-year-old, 4-year-old preschool and, you know, strong access to childcare. And, of course, those countries you pay more in taxes. But here I think the current strategies is looking at how to leverage the choices that are available from the entire sector, from the nonprofits, from the for-profits, from public schools and Head Start, making those choices available, especially to lower-income families. I'd also point out, though, is that other developing countries have taken this research to heart. And you visit China, India, places where they are really building their human capital development systems, their schools, and they are starting with preschool and early education and the type of supports we're talking about here.
Yeah, having now with my son at 4.5, I just think you look at the first couple of years of life. Anybody who has raised a child in those circumstances, occasionally you meet families, yeah, living in poverty, single-parent homes. I mean, the single moms, I say single moms because most single parents are moms, but they're single dads. Single parents, I just have so much love and respect for what you're going through and what you're trying to do. But sometimes you meet children who, you know, they're not hearing as much language. We know that kids should be hearing, you know, I don't know what the number is, but it's the difference in just the amount of spoken words kids in poverty tend to hear is amazing. And you just, it's hard to understand how this isn't, you know, viewed in very vital terms. But that's part of what we've been talking about. And Alyssa, to circle back to your email, sorry, I missed that point. She just wanted to know if our guest today, and it wouldn't be Rob, but maybe Jen and maybe Larry, she wants to know if you're going to get more forceful about calling out elected leaders who are, in her words, more engaged in the circular firing squad than finding solutions here.
Oh, we absolutely have no problem calling out public officials on the key decisions that need to be made. And again, you go to our website today at thechildrensagenda.org, and you'll find letters, one poised and focused on the governor, another one focused on our federal members of Congress to encourage them to make the changes necessary to do that. The Children's Agenda, that's our role, is to use an evidence base and the facts and data to drive public decision-making in a better direction, and that's what we'll do.
Okay. Jen?
Larry's organization and mine are also involved in Winning Beginning New York, which is the state's early learning coalition, a statewide coalition of advocates and other interested parties. So I would say to visit www.winningbeginningny.org and sign up for our e-advocacy alerts, which will allow people to keep up to date on what's happening in Albany and around the state, and will also afford people a very quick and easy way to contact legislative leaders from time to time.
Okay, how to sign up?
Yep, absolutely. Just click a button, fill in your name and your email, and we'll be in touch.
Jen is with Council for Strong America. And before I lose the hour, I wanted you to hit one more point, because I think it was 2014 when there was all this talk about pre-K, expanding pre-K, and there were a lot of broken arms from people who were really working hard to pat themselves on the back for what got done, which I think, at least that's my characterization, not Jen's. Look, I know it was there was a lot of discussion on it, and there was a lot of, I think, emphasis on expanding it at least age 4, maybe down to age 3. But for those who sort of haven't followed up on it, where does our state stand with pre-K?
We're still stuck with pre-K. We have started to expand to 3-year-olds, but as I said previously, less than 50% of 4-year-olds are served. Certainly my organization would like to see all of the 4-year-olds served, and then start to increase services, appropriate, developmentally appropriate services for 3-year-olds. We do know that 2 years of pre-K is better than 1, but unfortunately there are a number of 4-year-olds going without pre-K still. So we would like to see more of an investment. We are also working to see that the 8 different funding streams for pre-K are consolidated and streamlined so that every program has the same eligibility requirements and the same amount of money put in per pupil. So a lot of work to be done still on pre-K as we move forward.
Are we seeing on balance in this state the 4-year-olds who are in pre-K? You said it's about 50% or fewer than 50%?
Correct.
How does that break down in terms of socioeconomics that we understand?
We're not doing the greatest job there. There has not been a real concerted effort to target the highest need children, at least outside of New York City. And so we could definitely do better in terms of targeting the highest need first and then moving forward with a universal approach.
One real bright spot is Rochester, actually, on this front. The 4-year-old pre-K utilization rate is in the 90s, 90%. And that's in the city of some of the most, the kids who can get the most benefit from it, low-income kids. And it is a largely very high-quality system of pre-K. The problem we're finding is that the 3-year-olds and younger kids who are entering the pre-K system are showing such huge delays in so many different ways that we have to back this out earlier. And so 3-year-old screening is a really critical part of this. Children's Institute and Rock the Future are leading this massive community-wide program on 3-year-old integrated screening of physical and developmental screening. We need more home visitation, and we need the high-quality early child care to bridge to pre-K.
Okay, and that just dovetails with Rob's research that pre-K, great, not necessarily enough, or at least from what we've seen, there's a lot more that can happen at an earlier age.
That's correct, and that's particularly true for children from more disadvantaged environments, is that for those kids that are very much at risk, we want to be able to be working with pregnant mothers through home visiting programs and being able to support those families well before children reach the age of 4.
All right. Rob is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. 20 seconds. What research is happening now, or what are you working on now that you're most excited about to eventually be able to share with the world? Or what's interesting you the most right now in this category, Rob?
I think one of the areas of interest is really sorting through the research on quality. What are these, really being clear about what the ingredients of a high-quality program in these type of things, within home visiting, within childcare, within preschool, and doing the best going forward.
Okay. Larry Marks from the Children's Agenda. Final thoughts for listeners on this subject.
We need you. We need you to be involved. And the same letter is on the Winning Beginning New York and the Children's Agenda website. It's the same letter. It's coordinated. advocacy, but what's missing is you, and we need people to be involved in contacting their elected officials.
All right, one more time to get that letter then to see it.
At www.thechildrensagenda.org, and particularly organizational leaders, we're interested in having you sign up there.
Okay, and Jen, 20 seconds, final thoughts from you.
Same thing, just get involved. Go to www.winningbeginningny.org, and you can participate with just a click of a button.
Thanks for being here. Jen O'Connor is the New York State Director of Council for a Strong America. Nice having you here. Thank you. Larry Marks, Executive Director of the Children's Agenda. As always, Larry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
And Rob Grunewald in from Minneapolis, an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Thanks for being here, Rob.
Great to be here.
Short break and more connections next.